I'd like to mention before we begin the shiur this evening that next week we will not have a shiur. That's Parshas Vayigash. We'll meet again, Mirtz Hashem, in 2 weeks' time. We are 2 days before Chanukah, and I'd like to devote this evening's discussion to aspects of Chanukah, beginning with some of the matters that relate to the mitzvah of Chanukah, Hadlokas HaMenorah, and then moving on to some thematic material with regards to the 8 days that are coming. So with regards to the mitzvah of Chanukah, the mitzvah of Chanukah lights, it's a unique mitzvah in many respects. Firstly, there are three levels to the mitzvah. We do not find that in any other mitzvah. There is the basic mitzvah, there's Mahadrin, and whereas every mitzvah, or as a rule, mitzvahs have a concept, a notion of Hidur mitzvah, to beautify the mitzvah, Chanukah certainly has that, Mahadrin, and then it has Mahadrin mina Mahadrin. Mahadrin mina Mahadrin is the third level of Chanukah. It has, those words have since been lifted and used in many other contexts. None of them are halachic. The only mitzvah that has a category called Mahadrin min Mahadrin is Ner Chanukah. That's the only mitzvah that doesn't require your credit card details at the bottom. Now the Gemara describes the three levels, and it's fascinating because we're so used to essentially doing the highest level, Mahadrin min Mahadrin, we don't realize that there's any levels below. It's like people that travel first class, they didn't realize there was an economy class. But the basic mitzvah, it's almost shocking to hear if you've never heard it before. The mitzvah of Chanukah, says the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, of course, in Perek Bamei Madlikin, Daf Kaf Aleph Amud Beis, mitzvah Chanukah, Ner Ish Ubeiso. The basic baseline mitzvah is just one light, that one person lights for the entire household. There may be five people living in the house. He just lights the one light. Every night. And that's it. Mahadrin, the Hamahadrin, those that wish to go further, do more. Level two is Ner Lekol Echad Ve'Echad. A light for each person. If there's five people living in the house, five lights. That's already a step up. But it's five lights every night. The first and the second, still five. Until the eighth night, it will always be five. It doesn't move, not up, not down. And finally, there is the level that we are familiar with, Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, whereby not only do you add candles, but it changes with the day. And here we have the famous Machlokas Beis Hillel Beis Shammai, how to go about Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. Beis Hillel, which of course is how we follow, is Mosifim, the Holchim. You begin with one and you build up to eight. For Beis Shammai, Posim V'Holchim. Actually, start with eight and you build down to one. So much is the highest level, Mahadrin min Mahadrin, embedded in our consciousness. It's very interesting to note, the Shulchan Aruch, when he codifies the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, doesn't even mention the first two levels. He only mentions the Mahadrin min Mahadrin and doesn't even refer to it as such. This is the mitzvah. So much has it been received. But it's important to note, important to be aware, that the basic mitzvah is yet one light. If a person were ever in a situation where they only had one light, and it's the fifth light of Chanukah, they may be in danger, perhaps, of missing out on the mitzvah if they didn't realize that the basic mitzvah is the one light. They may feel it's six or nothing, which is not the case. So the minhag is the third level, Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, but the nature of the mitzvah can be discerned through examining levels 1 and 2. The basic mitzvah and then the Mahadrin, as we will see. We should note, actually, that as we move to Mahadrin, which is Ner Lekol Echad Ve'Echad, a light for each person in the house, there's an interesting shaila. Who lights those lights? The people in the house? And here, there's a difference of opinion or difference of practice between it seems, Sfardim and Ashkenazim. Certainly, in terms of the people behind this, the Ramah in Hilchas Chanukah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, states, V'yesh omrim dekol echad mibnei habayis yadlik. As we begin to add candles for each person in the house, that means that each person in the house lights their light. And that to us may seem very straightforward. If there's five people in the house, you'll expect five people lighting, each one their menorah. The Rambam, however, in the beginning of Perek Dalet of Hilchas Chanukah, states, he begins with the basic mitzvah, the hamahader is a mitzvah, and if someone wants to do more, madlik neiros kiminyan anshe habayis. He lights in accordance with the number of people in the house. Ner lekol echad ve'echad. A light for each person. So it's very interesting because according to the Rambam, the Mahadrim, which is Ner lekol echad ve'echad, isn't each person lighting. It's still the Balabayas lighting. But instead of just lighting the one light for the whole household, he lights a light for each person living in the house. But it's him that lights the five. And interesting to consider what's behind this machlokas. Did they diversify? Did they split up? Is it still him? But he lights more lights. In terms of the tone of the words, ner lekol echad ve'echad, you could see that it could absorb both possibilities. Because ner lekol echad ve'echad means a light for each person. Okay, but does that mean a light to each person, as if to say each person comes and takes a light and lights it? Or it's still the one person, but he lights a light lekol echad ve'echad. It can still go either way. And indeed, we have a machlokas. What is behind this machlokas? So that's in terms of level two, when you increase for the number of the people in the household, who does the lighting? But now, finally, let us approach level one of the mitzvah, the basic mitzvah of Ner Ish Ubeso. And we will discover there is a fascinating and fundamental question about the nature of mitzvahs Chanukah itself. We say the mitzvah is Ner Ish Ubeso, a light for a person and his house. What exactly does that mean? And let us preface by identifying actually two types of mitzvahs. The first type, which you could say is most mitzvahs, are obligations on the individual. And many mitzvahs are like that, the obligation of Shema, and of Tefillah. There are even obligations that involve objects, but it's the obligation on the person to fulfill the mitzvah through that object. It's generated by the person. And therefore on Sukkot, for 8 days of the year, 7 days of the year, a person wakes up in the morning with a standing obligation of Arba Minim. He may not have Arba Minim, he needs to get hold of them. It involves an object, but through the object he fulfills his obligation. And as we said, most mitzvahs are like this. Is there any other kind? Yes. There is another type of mitzvah where it doesn't devolve on a person, but it devolves on an object. And there, it's not so much a personal requirement to do something, but more an object-generated requirement that something be done. It's much more task-related in that respect, result-related. And a classic example of this type of mitzvah is the mitzvah of putting a mezuzah on one's house. It's a mitzvah, but actually what generates the mitzvah is the house. It's the ownership of a house. A person does not have an obligation to put a mezuzah on a house. If he owns a house, the house requires a mezuzah. And if we could perhaps demonstrate this in even more simple terms, if a person doesn't own a house, he has no obligation to purchase one for the purposes of attaching a mezuzah. Thus far, his obligation doesn't go. In fact, if he doesn't own a house, he doesn't have an obligation. But what does that mean? Is he not Jewish? Every Jew has to have a mezuzah. No, a Jewish home has to have a mezuzah. If you're a Jew living in that house, you need to see to it. But it's interesting to consider that someone needs to put a mezuzah up. Many people move into a house And the mezuzah are already there. They may never affix a mezuzah in their life. It's all done for them. And whoever did it did them a favor, but he wasn't motzi them, or one can't even talk in those terms. The mezuzah may have been affixed to the house before this person was born. And it's acceptable, because the house is taken care of. So if they're becoming crystallized, these two types of mitzvahs, mitzvah on the person or a mitzvah on the object. And now we ask the question, with regards to the mitzvah of menorah, what is the nature of the mitzvah? Shall we say that it's like many mitzvahs, most mitzvahs even, it's on the person. He has a mitzvah to light, as surely as in Purim he has a mitzvah to hear the Megillah. And if he doesn't have a Megillah, he needs to get hold of one. So too, every individual has an obligation to light the menorah. Now, if that's true, then the notion that one person can light for everyone is a chiddush. The notion, if everyone has an obligation, five people in the house, they're all over bar and bas mitzvah, there are five obligations there. One person lights the candle, which is the basic mitzvah, and everyone's okay. How did everyone become okay? Since when has it been acceptable just to observe one person doing his mitzvah and you are fulfilled your obligation for yours? That can't work. The closest we've seen this is, let's say, being motzi someone in kiddush, but that's a mechanism which is called shomea ka'ona. When you hear a person, you've got to hear them, and kavana, etc., and so forth, whether it's reading the Megillah or hearing the shofar, blowing the shofar, whatever it is. But you can't observe a person fulfilling their mitzvah and it's like you did yours. The head of the household can't shake a lulav and everyone just gather around and watch. Everyone has their own obligation. And therefore, if indeed it is an obligation on the individual, embedded within this mitzvah is a unique chiddush. One person can be motzi the members of the household, their obligation. If he didn't do it, four other people would have to do it. But once he's done it, he's motzi them. Alternatively, could it be that the mitzvah of Chanukah lights is like the other category? It's a function of the house. It's like a mezuzah. The house requires a menorah. As if to say, for every day of the year, the house requires a mezuzah. And for 8 days of the year, for half an hour, it requires two mezuzahs. One is the parchment of the mezuzah, and another is a mezuzah of fire, giving the message of Chanukah. But it's a function of the house. A person's house needs to have a menorah burning. How can we tell? It's a fascinating question to consider that it's almost like that a Jewish home requires menorah burning on Chanukah. And therefore we well understand that the basic mitzvah, one person can light, just like one person affixes a mezuzah, and it's done. The house has been treated, and it's okay, and everyone living in that house is thereby okay. Now, interestingly, the Gemara itself possibly seems to be addressing this question. For the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Kaf Gimel, tells us the following ruling. Achsanai. And achsanai is from the word achsanya, which we may be familiar with. A guest, a lodger or a guest. You should know, says the Gemara, an achsanai, a guest, is chayev in Ner Chanukah. He's also got a light. And many Meforshim are quite puzzled by this Gemara, because just because he's a guest, it doesn't mean he's exempt from mitzvahs. I mean, he's got to do everything. He's got to make kiddush, and he's got to daven, and he's got to do... But yet we're being told that the guest needs to light Chanukah lights. Is there a chiddush here? And here, some Rishonim explain that this is exactly the point that the Gemara seeks to emphasize. Namely, you may have thought that as surely as the person needs to affix a mezuzah to the door, and he's also got to have a menorah lighting in the house, you may have thought that it's like mezuzah. And if that's true, then a guest would be exempt. Because if you're staying in someone's house and the door doesn't have a mezuzah, you don't have an obligation to affix a mezuzah. You're just staying there for a night or a week or something like that. And therefore you may have thought that in the same way that a guest in someone's house, he has no responsibilities to the house. to treat it by fixing a mezuzah. So you may have thought he doesn't have an obligation of menorah either. And thus we are told, and the Gemara emphasizes, no, it's not like mezuzah. Whereas it's not your room, and you don't have to worry about mezuzah, but menorah, it's not like that. It's about you, and you have an obligation of mezuzah. So according to some, that's exactly what the Gemara is seeking to emphasize, that menorah is not like mezuzah. However, if we were to understand that in fact it is like mezuzah, for 8 days one has the second mezuzah called the menorah, then Mefarshim explain that it could be the Gemara seeking to emphasize something else. For the mitzvah of mezuzah, you've got to own the house. It's got to be yours or living there for a significant amount of time, otherwise you have no obligation. But for Chanukah, because Chanukah is only 8 days a year, so the question of what's called your house is also judged accordingly. And if you're staying here tonight, then for tonight, this is your house, and that's why you're obligated in the mitzvah of menorah. So it could yet go either way. Again, to summarize, either the chiddush of the guest is that even though it's not your house, it doesn't have to be your house for the mitzvah of menorah because menorah is on you. Or maybe it is on the house. But the point is, when it comes to Chanukah, where you're staying tonight, for Chanukah, that's your house. For this night of Chanukah, that's your house. And many Mefarshim say that it is in this regard that the Ramah and the Rambam that we mentioned earlier part ways. They are divided on the nature of the mitzvah of Chanukah. And let us see how that works. According to the Ramah, it is an obligation on the individual, as is the case with most mitzvahs. A person has to do any number of mitzvahs, and they also have to light the menorah. As we mentioned, if that's true, then there's a chiddush, that in principle, it's possible that just the balabayit lights, and everyone else is yotzei. It's possible. But then the question is, what's mahadrin? Mahadrin means ner lekol echad ve'echad. Why is that a hidur? What is the hidur? So Rabbi Kiva Eger explains that the hidur, if indeed the obligation really does rest with each individual, but there exists the possibility of being yotzei through the balabayit, you can, it's okay. But the hidur says, no, I don't want to be yotzei with the balabayit. I don't want to just do nothing and have someone do my mitzvah for me, even if I can. The hidur is to elect not to be yotzei with the balabayit, but rather, I want to do the mitzvah myself. Vakasha. If you want to do your mitzvah yourself, absolutely. If you don't want to be yotzei with a balabayit, you're fully obligated now to do it yourself. And so they do. And each person makes a bracha. So it's almost like the mahadrin for the Ramah, for Meir Ashkenaz, is reclaiming, each person reclaiming the mitzvah that's really his. He's not opting to have someone be motzi. Whereas, according to the Rambam, interesting to consider, how does he view this matter? The Rambam has a unique phrase that he uses as he introduces the mitzvah of Chanukah. And these are his words. Mitzvasa, what is the basic mitzvah? Shehiyeh kol bayis ubayis madlik ner echad. Every house lights one light. That's very interesting. It's a very graphic term. The Rambam has described the house lighting. He hasn't even spoken about a person lighting. And many Mefarshim understand that what the Rambam means to say is Ner Ishu Beiso means the house has to light. It's a mitzvah on the house. Like a house needs a mezuzah, a house needs a menorah for these 8 days. And if that's true, we well understand the basic mitzvah is one person lights. Because why should anyone else light? If I put up a mezuzah, so everyone's okay. That's actually normal. That's a natural shape of the mitzvah. What then is mahadrin? If the house only needs one menorah, what's the mahadrin? Well, Rambam says, if you wish to be mahadir is a mitzvah, so instead of just lighting just the one light, so what light? A light for everyone. But we can well understand why it will only ever be the balabayit who's lighting, because this is his mezuzah, this is the menorah for the house. There's only meaning for one person to be lighting the menorah. If there's more lights to be added, it will be him that's adding them to beautify his mitzvah. But no one else has a mitzvah, for he represents the house. And therefore, we see how what seemed to be a very practical machlokas in terms of Mahadrin, they split up in light, or the Balabayat lights for all of them, actually reflects a fundamental question as to the nature of the mitzvah of Chanukah. And what's further interest is that it could be that the understanding of how Mahadrin works may even depend on what the word Mahadrin means. If we could imagine that Mahadrin could mean more than one thing. It could. What does Mahadrin mean? If asked, I think we would say that Mahadrin, it comes from the word Hidur, Hidur mitzvah, there's the basic mitzvah, and then to be Mahadrin the mitzvah. Okay, to beautify the mitzvah. And indeed, that's how the Rambam explains it. As he presents, V'amahader is ha-mitzvah, one who beautifies the mitzvah, he'll light more candles. That's one possibility. However, for me, the chiddush was in Rashi. The best kept secret in the halacha here was right at the side of the page of Gemara in Rashi's commentary. For he, and it almost goes unnoticed unless you chap it, commenting on the words Mahadrin, says Rashi, achar ha-mitzvos, after mitzvos. How can you be Mahadir after mitzvos? Rashi is saying a big chiddush. According to Rashi, the word Mahadrin doesn't mean to beautify. It doesn't relate to the Hebrew word Hadar, or Hidur. In fact, not only does it relate to the word Hidur, the Hebrew word Hidur, it's not a Hebrew word at all. It's an Aramaic word. The word, which can happen in the Gemara, there are a few. The word Mahadrin comes from the Aramaic word Hadar, which means to return. And what do we say at a Siyum? Hadranalach, we will come back. Hadar is the Aramaic for the Hebrew word lachzor. And therefore Mahadrin, which Rashi explained as Mahadrin achar ha-mitzvahs, means chozrim achar ha-mitzvahs. People who are mechazun achar ha-mitzvahs, they're pursuing mitzvahs. It's not about beautifying mitzvahs, it's about pursuing mitzvahs. Now, what's this got to do with pursuing mitzvahs? How can this be a description of that? But I think, and some suggest, this is the source of the Ramah, that Mahadrin means each person lights. Because that's Mahadrin. Each person pursues the mitzvah themselves. They're not content to have someone do the mitzvah for them. They are Mahadrin achar ha-mitzvahs. I want to do the mitzvah myself. That's Mahadrin. And therefore, it just in its lishoni aspect, the question as to how Mahadrin works may indeed be rooted back to really what the word Mahadrin means, and indeed what language it is. Mahadrin as Hidur, as Hadar, or Mahadrin as Lachzor. Now should we ask, as we come to the, let's say, practicalities, the brass tacks, as they say, does it make a difference as to, aside from the difference that we said, in terms of, does each person light for themselves, or it's still the balabayit for each person, are there any other practical differences? So Rav Soloveitchik suggested, I don't know if this is normative practice, because this is for the Sfardim, and because one needs to check in, but it could be a very simple nafkemina. What if there are five people living in the house? Husband, the wife, and three young children, ages 1, 2, and 3? How many lights are lit, for example, on the first night of Hanukkah? Well, if you're Ashkenazi, one. Interestingly, there's five people in the house, you're going Mahadrin, and it's still only one, because the husband and wife are one unit, either of them could light for each other, right? They're Ishta Kugufo, so that's that. And no one else has a mitzvah, because the three other occupants of the house are underage, by all definitions, 1, 2, and 3. So there'll be one light lit. According to the Rambam, there'll be five lights lit. Because ner lekol echad ve'echad, it's not about people fulfilling obligation. It's a way of expressing, using the number of people, the number of Jews in the house, as a metric for ribui neiros, for increasing light. There are five people in the house. So that is a basic difference between these two. Another very interesting possibility is raised by Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zatzal. And it's quite far-reaching, I would say. He subscribes to the position, as seems to be the position of the Rambam, that it's an obligation on the house. Now, how far does this go? If it's an obligation of the house, as we know, if one of the family members are out of the house, the other members at home can still light for them. That's actually in the Gemara. If the husband is somehow not home at lighting time, the wife can light for him, and vice versa. So, Shlomo Zalman, what if the husband's in another country? Or perhaps, what if the husband is in another time zone? Whereby his wife is in Israel, and he's in the States, which is a good few hours behind, and now she wants to light for him. The only thing is, not only is he not at home, he's not at Hanukkah. Because on the first night, it's still Arab, it's the middle of the afternoon, or late or morning, when she's already lighting, it's not Hanukkah for him. Says of Shlomo Zalman, but it's Hanukkah for his house. His house is already in Hanukkah. And therefore, you have an amazing situation whereby it's Hanukkah for his house, but not for him. And Shlomo Zalman, Paskin, she can light for him. Ad kedei kach, because it's a mitzvah, the house generates the chiyuv, and the house is already in Hanukkah. That's a chiddush. The final point, and interestingly, this question, which is so, on the one hand, it's rather abstract. On the other hand, it doesn't get more fundamental in terms of an appreciation of the nature of the mitzvah of Hanukkah. But this was discussed halacha lemaisa. It really came up in the poskim about 40 years ago. In the Yom Kippur War. Because although the war began on Yom Kippur, it didn't end on Yom Kippur. And still weeks later, in Hanukkah, there were still many soldiers in the field. And they sent the question back to the poskim. In other words, some of them, and they had all sorts of sleeping arrangements, or the lack thereof. And do they have a mitzvah of Hanukkah? And it revolved around this question, because we say, ne'er ishu beiso. But they weren't really living in a house. None of them were living in houses. They were either in tents or in trenches or none of the above. And this is why the poskim began to address this question, because there was a tzibur of religious soldiers who wanted to know what's their obligation. Obviously, they weren't interested in being mefarsem to the other side exactly where the menorah was, but nonetheless. And an opinion was divided, and it's over this question that Tzitz Eliezer is of the opinion that it's an obligation on the person, and their issue beso is about the people in the house, and even if a person has no house, even if he's sleeping under the stars with nothing over his head or anything of the sort, he's 100% obligated in the mitzvah of Hanukkah. That's Tzitz Eliezer. But Shlomo Zalman, on the other hand, was of the opinion that no one does need a house. Sorts, one does need a dwelling. Ne'er ishu beiso, he's going with the Rambam, called bayis u'bayis. But he did concede that, once again, the relationship with the house is transient, and also the type, what qualifies as a house is also transient. In other words, a tent is also considered a house for this, but if a person is mamish sleeping under the stars with nothing that evening over his head, that by no definition could be termed a dwelling or house at all, however temporary, he'd be exempt from the mitzvah of Hanukkah, said Shlomo Zalman. And if he's in a trench, and that's it, so there's no mitzvah. But then, just as a P.S., because it was so, it's Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Shlomo Zalman said, if he's in a trench, there's no roof over his head. So that's not a dwelling. However, says Shlomo Zalman, it depends how deep the trench is. Because the halacha states, Hilchos Shabbos, that a hole in the ground that is more than 10 tefachim deep, which is 80 centimeters deep, is a separate domain, it's a separate rishus. In Shabbos, if you would carry from the street and deposit in that pit, or vice versa, it's like taking from a public domain to a private domain. And therefore, says Shlomo Zalman, if we accept that any definition of a new domain would be acceptable for Hanukkah, a trench that's 10 tefachim deep is also a new domain. And it's your rishus that it be chayav in Hanukkah, which is unbelievable. Because anyone who's learned the halachas of Shabbos, they know that a pit is 10 tefachim. Everyone knows it. And who would recall it or bring it to bear or imagine that would any have nafkamina ever? La halacha. But for Shlomo Zalman, every halach is a living presence. It's always there, and you never know when it will happen. And if it's Hanukkah, then the Gemara and Shabbos is right there for you. So these are some of the highlights of the question of the nature of the mitzvah of Hanukkah. There are a number of opinions, and we have 8 days to reflect upon the details of each. And from there, we move to discuss also the theme of Hanukkah, the message of Hanukkah. Hanukkah for us is about our confrontation with Yavon. It's a cultural confrontation. It's an ideological confrontation. They made demands of us that we were not prepared to accept, and we went to war. The confrontation, we should know, did not begin with the Hashmonai, as far as Chazal are concerned. The conflict between Torah and Yavon and Greece did not begin, not with Antiochus and not with Mattathiah. It began generations earlier. The very first, in a sense, act of aggression of Greece against Israel was the forced translation of the Torah into Greek, what becomes known as the Septuaginta, the Targum HaShivim. And indeed, Maseches Sofrim, which is compiled in the times of the Gaonim, Maseches Sofrim, goes so far as to state, and it's actually Paskan in Shulchan Aruch, the date of the translation of the Torah is known. It's the 8th of Teves. And the Maseches Sofrim says that the 8th of Teves, for those that are able, it's one of those higher level, it's a fast day. Because it's a day of tragedy. It's a day the Torah is translated into Greek. And the Maseches Sofrim goes so far as to say, V'kosha haya oso hayom, k'yom shenasa bo ha'egel. That day was as harsh for the Jewish people as the day that the eagle was made. Now that's an association that's needs to be understood. And the day of the eagle was a day of undisputed national tragedy. It was our first. And this is like that. How was this like that? What exactly is the problem with the Torah being translated into Greek? And the subtext, sub-question, of course, is if it's not translated into Greek, then Greek people won't be able to understand it. And is there no notion of, let's say, spreading Torah or giving a message of Torah to the nations of the world? So here it is. They've sponsored a translation, and now they have its message is available to them. And somehow, no, this isn't part of that. That's a beneficial thing. This is a tragedy. Why is it a tragedy? What we see from the notion of translating the Torah, as much as there was a religious conflict between Yavon and Israel, no question about it, the war was about that in the end. But they're not looking to destroy or suppress the Torah. Because if they were, they wouldn't have had the Torah translated into Greek, they would have had it burnt. And others have done that. So it's interesting because they don't view the Torah as their enemy. And they're happy for it to exist, and they're even interested in having it translated. But clearly they do have an agenda. What is their target? What's their goal? Their goal is not to destroy the Torah. Their goal is to dilute the Torah, to universalize it, to take it out of the exclusive domain of the Jewish people, as if to say, and here's the book, and everyone can have one. And everyone can do what they want with it, and say what they want about it. It's no longer the Jewish people's exclusive domain. And the same is true in terms of their religious demands. Because originally, as we know, they did not intend to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. It came to it because they made an unacceptable demand to put an idol in the Beis HaMikdash. As if to say, they have no problem with each country that they defeat pursuing its religious, its the deity. But here's another one! And why should there be a conflict between the two? They're looking to make the whole notion of religious service inclusionary. And why not? And that is exactly the point of conflict between Yavan and Yisrael. As if to say, Greece is dictating to Israel what are the terms of Israel's religion should be. The central text of the Torah shouldn't be just for you. We'd like to have one also. And your allegiance shouldn't be just towards God, your God, but it can be to ours also. So they're looking to break down any type of boundary or barrier that makes that, or that defines Judaism, or the distinction of Judaism. The oppression of Greece is summed up in the words of the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, commenting on the second pasuk in the Torah, where the four exiles are already alluded to, Va'aretz Ha'satohu, Va'vohu, V'choshech Abnei Tahom, and the third term is Choshech, which the Medrash says, Choshech is Yavan, is Greece. Shehechshichu Einehem Shel Yisrael, they darken the eyes of Israel. How so? They said, and this now becomes a famous phrase, Kisvu Lachem Al Keren Ashor, She'ein Lachem Chelek B'Elokei Yisrael. Write on the horn of an ox that you have no portion in the God of Israel. That's a very specific thing to ask of the Jewish people, and that's hardly their only demand. But it's representative of what Greece wants. What's the Keren Ashor? Well, the Rambam famously says in his Igeres Hashmad, one of his epistles, that Keren Ashor is the horn of the ox, in the sense that Israel was largely agricultural at that time. The farmer's most prized possession is his ox. The horn of the ox is the most prominent place of the most prized possession of the Jew. Write it there. It's almost like, it's the opposite of Pirsum Minissa. It is publicizing your detachment from Judaism. It has to be professed there. That's the notion of the horn of the ox. In our terminology nowadays, it would be probably closer to a bumper sticker. But the Maharal in the Sefer Ner Mitzvah has a different interpretation of Keren Hashor, and it's shared by Rashi, the commentary that's attributed to Rashi on Bereishis Rabbah. Maharal says, Keren Hashor, the ox, is often used in Chazal as a representation, and a reference to the eagle, the Chet HaEgel, because the eagle comes from the shore. Even the pasuk refers to the eagle as a shore. Himru kavodam betavnis shore. So in a sense, why are they bringing up the eagle? What's that got to do with anything? The question of how to evaluate the golden calf is critical in terms of understanding the nature of the Jewish people. We say that we have an exclusive bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He is Echad, and we are Amcha Yisrael, Goy Echad Ba'aretz. He has no other nation, we have no other God. And other nations may pursue other paths, but that's got nothing to do with us. Chet HaEgel raises a major question about that. Because very soon into our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we seem to have shifted allegiance to this other address. That's the eagle. What does it say about the Jewish people? Well, that's the machlokas. Greece looks upon the eagle as essentially confirmation that the Jewish people are no different than any other people. And we have lots of deities, and you pretty much diversified quite soon. So you're like us. So why are you being so obstinate? Keren Ashor refers to, what does the eagle say about you? It says, She'ein lechem chelek b'lekei Yisrael. You can also be connected to him. It doesn't mean you have to be disconnected from anything else. You connected to the eagle, which means you're not exclusively bound up with Hashem. That's the issue. In reality, however, the Chet HaEgel was the product of many other different factors. It's not about the essence of the Jewish people. It's about spillover from being in Mitzrayim, where there was a lot of Avodah Zarah going on. It was a time of confusion. It was a time of many, many things. But the essential question is this a defining act on the part of the Jewish people? That's the question. And in fact, we find the Jewish people in a most fascinating Gemara, it's in the fifth parak of Maseches Brachos, on Batom Etzion as Avani Hashem, which is that one of the Haftorahs in the Shivat and the Chemta. So the Jewish people say, Hashem has forgotten me. Hashem says, no, a woman would forget her own child. Gam Eile Tishkachna Va'anuchi Lo Ashkachech. Even that would happen before I'd forget you. Hatishkach Isha Ula Me'achem Ben Bitna. A woman would never forget her child, and that would happen before I'd forget you. Gam Eile Tishkachna Va'anuchi Lo Ashkachech. So the Gemara says, Hashem says, I'll never forget you. And the Jewish people said, well, that actually might not be so advantageous for us because there's some things we don't want you to remember. Shema lo tishkach li ma'aseh egel, maybe you won't forget the egel, because we'd actually like you to forget the egel. Is that okay? And Hashem says, the egel I'll forget. Gam eile tishkachna. Eile is a motif word for the egel, which was introduced to the Jewish people as eile Elohecha Yisrael. I'll forget Eile. Don't worry, it's forgotten. That's good. But then the Jewish people got nervous. Oh, well then if you're already forgetting things, then maybe you forget too much. I mean, it's unbelievable what the Gemara is saying. Because then maybe you'll forget Ma'amad Har Sinai. Because if you're already forgetting. So Hashem says, no. V'anochi lo eshkachich. I won't forget Anochi. Anochi Hashem Elokech is there. So this kind of seesawing, which is impossible to even begin to talk about. Hashem is, yes, forgetting, not forgetting, forgetting this, but then not too much, but then comes back to the middle. But the Maharal says the notion of Hashem either forgetting or remembering something means, is this how he looks at the Jewish people? When he looks at the Jewish people, does he see the egel? Is that part of their makeup? Is that part of their definition? That's what the Jewish people are worried about. You remember everything, that means you remember everything we've done. Maybe everything we've done is a part of us. That including the egel, is that true? Hashem says, no, it's not true. I'll forget it because that isn't you. It happened very soon after Kabbalah Sator, but it's not you, rest assured. But then the Jewish people actually have no longer have any idea who they are. Because if something so early maybe doesn't represent them, but maybe maybe Nasav and Ishmael doesn't represent them. That also happened early. Who knows who they really are? Hashem says, I'll never forget Sinai. When I look at you, I think of Sinai. Because that is you. And that's the question. And therefore, this is the Maral's interpretation, Maral and Rashi, of Keren Hashor, as if to say the Egel, it's a statement about you. You're not as unique as you think you are, and your connection with Hashem isn't as unique as you think it is. So ease up, and we'll all be friends. The uniqueness of the connection between us and Hashem, it finds most acute expression actually with Torah Shebal Peh. So says the Gemara in Maseches Gittin, the bris, the firm connection, lo karas HaKadosh Baruch Hu brisim Yisrael, el al pi Torah Shebal Peh. Because in a sense, as we've seen, the Achumish is written down. And once it's written down, it can fall prey to any hand who can then claim it as their own. But the word of mouth, it retains a kind of an intimacy. It retains a connection that if you don't know what it means, then you're not really in. And that's why the bris is based on Torah Shebal Peh. That's why the symbol of Chanukah is the menorah. There's many kelim in the Beis HaMikdash, and one could imagine, had it been different, let's say, because they restarted all of the avodas in the Beis HaMikdash, and if they didn't have enough spices for the ketores, I don't know what Chanukah would look like. But it's equally something that they did. But there's no question that the menorah stands out from all of the appurtenances in the Samigdash. And the reason why is because the menorah represents Torah Shebal Peh. There are two vessels in the Beis Hamikdash, in the Mishkan, that refer to Torah, express Torah. The Aron, which has the Luchos in it, and then the menorah. And the Netziv describes in many places, and as do others, that there are two vessels because they correspond to the two aspects of Torah, the two parts of Torah. And the menorah is Torah Shebal Peh. And therefore, essentially, the menorah, more than anything else, is under attack. Because once Torah Shebal Peh is neutralized, Torah Shebichtav is putty in the hands of anyone who translates it into whatever language they do. And it's interesting that the Gemara says, the bris between us and Hashem was based on Torah Shebal Peh. As it says, Hashem says, "Ksov lecha es hadvar me'ele." Write these words. Ki al pi hadvar me'ele karati et chabris. This is in Parshas Kisisa. Because based on these words, I've cut the bris between me and you. So where is the reference to Torah Shebal Peh? Al pi hadvar me'ele. But if you look at the words, it says al pi hadvar me'ele, and hadvar me'ele is what you wrote down. That's Torah Shebichtav. So is the bris based on Torah Shebal Peh? Through the word Alpi, or is it the Torah Shebichtav, which is Advar Ma'ele, which you've written down, Ksav Lecha is Advar Ma'ele. But the Chasam Sofer says, Torah Shebal Peh is part of Torah Shebichtav, but only in Hebrew. In other words, the Gemara itself says there isn't anything which isn't somehow alluded to in the Torah. You have the words, and you have pshat, and you have drash, and you have remez, and you have sod, and the drash and the remez, if you know how to look at the psukim in that way, you will essentially derive what we know is Torah Shebal Peh. And that's why the pasuk says, write these words, Loshon HaKodesh, ki al pi advar me'ele, because based on these words, you have Torah Shebal Peh. So many different ways to look at the pasuk. With Rosh Tevas and Safei Tevas and Gematria, and it's all part of the illusions. What's explicit in the Pasuk is Torah Shebichtav. What's alluded to is the whole world of Torah Shebal Peh. As soon as you take the Torah and you take it from Lashon HaKodesh and translate it into another language, you have lost all of that. What are you left with? The Bible. Even an accurate translation can never recreate or can never contain any of that entirely, that different world known as Torah Shebal Peh. The gematria of the word beginning, it doesn't start. If ever it was appropriate to apply the term lost in translation, that's what happened with the Torah. In other words, in order to spread the message of Torah, that's one thing. But here the agenda of Greece was not to spread the message. It's to hijack the message. It's to commandeer it, as if to say, as soon as the Torah is in Greek, so that's our domain. And there's no more references to Torah Shebal Peh, and all you have are the words, the way we would translate them, and then it's up to us. And once that's true, so then that severs the bond, or compromises the bond between the Jewish people and Hashem. Because they also have the book, and they have their own things that they'd like to say about it. And that's why the Maseches Sofrim says the day they translated the Torah into Greek was as difficult for the Jewish people as the day the Egel was made. Because it was the same thing. As if to say, for Greece, this is an Egel achievement. As surely as they saw within the Egel the fact that the Jewish people don't have this exclusive relationship with Hashem, they're looking to make good on that by taking the Torah over and explaining it in a way where it no longer has anything to do with it, this relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem. It is an emanation and a reverberation of the Egel. And it was as difficult as the day the Egel was made. Mefarshim raised the question. This is one of the classic questions of Chanukah. We know the story that all the oil was tameh, betimu kalashmanim. Every child knows the story. And they searched and searched until finally they found and the miracle happened. And that's Chanukah. So the halachists are looking to question here. What was the problem? All the oil is tameh. So? They can't use it. That's not true. The halacha happens to be that for the sake of avodas tzibur and lighting of the menorah is avodas tzibur, tuma dechuya betzibur, tuma is pushed aside for the concerns of betzibur. Some say tuma hutra betzibur, it's mutter lechatchila. According to some, which means the difference between them is that either listen, if you begun to search and it didn't work out, if you don't see it around, you can use tamei oil, and according to the second position, you don't even have to look. The first thing that you pick up is tamei, so be it. Tuma hutra betzibur, it's mutter. Which is a very disturbing question, because Because what about the rest of the story of Hanukkah? I mean, why are they looking? And it sounds like they were in danger of having to do something that's completely acceptable. That doesn't really sound like such a bad thing. So why are they looking? Well, the classic response is that it's true, they didn't need to look, but for the sake of rededicating the Beis HaMikdash, they went the extra mile. It's mutter, but they knew that, listen, at the end of the day, Tahor is better. So they went the extra mile, or to put it in other words, they were mahader achar mitzvahs. I mean, they went in pursuit of mitzvahs to do them in the best possible way. It's hidur mitzvah. It's acceptable to use tamei oil, but it's still hidur to use tahor oil. And that's why hidur is such an integral part of the mitzvah of Chanukah, because the whole mitzvah is born off of hidur mitzvah. If they weren't mahadrin, there would be no mitzvah. So the mitzvah is, it's harosso veledosso, its inception comes from hidur mitzvah. Rav Osher Weiss says something else. If our question is, isn't it acceptable to use a tamei oil? That's a halacha. So why do you? What's all the fuss about? Why are you going off to tahor oil? So Rav Weiss says, in general, it is acceptable to use tamei oil, but not here, because that's exactly why the Greeks were metame the oil. That's what it's all about. This is part of the confrontation. We say, you see, that's really the question. All the oil was tame. How did it come to be tame? It just so happened to be tame. It's just like a detail. This wasn't a detail. This was a programmatic assault on the part of Yavan, as if to say, take it or leave it. This is what we're saying the whole time. How do they make it tame? Because the Yavanim shouldn't have come into contact with it. It's got to be preserved. So Yavan says, well, no. Even if we're involved in your service, it doesn't make a difference. That's what we demand. That's what we maintain. Vitimu kol ashmanim was deliberate. And the challenge thrown down to the Jewish people is, we've been metame, and it shouldn't make a difference. Because so what? It's all good. So the tame oil represents the struggle. And that's why under normal circumstances, it's a fascinating approach. Under normal circumstances, mashu kara, the oil became tame. It's mutter, lechatchile, bidyevet. But this is really the question. There, it's a policy statement. We're metame the oil, and it shouldn't make a difference to you. Now it makes a difference. Because that, what was the war about, if not this? And therefore, on this occasion, it was unacceptable to use oil that had become tame on purpose. They searched and they found, and that was a requirement of the time. Fascinating. And this is the lesson of Chanukah, of the lessons, but it's a major lesson of Chanukah, because at the end of the day, it's the question the Jewish people need to be asking themselves the whole time. And Chanukah is given to us as a chag for the Golos, because we need it in the Golos. And we're still in Golos. And the Chanukah itself teaches us that Golos can follow us back into Israel. And as long as we are in that state, it is of the essence to have a correct self-definition. Because that's the harshest form of oppression is dilution. Because if the definition of the Jewish people is based on their distinction, then any move towards dilution in the end will be a distortion. It will be the opposite of the truth. And unfortunately we see it happen. It's a question that is being asked about to the Jewish people the whole time. How do we define ourselves? What is unique to us? What do we have in common with others? Where do we draw the boundaries? Those boundaries are being bombarded the whole time. It's very interesting to note. Perhaps we'll conclude with how we started. We began with the halachic discussion as to the nature of the mitzvah of Chanukah. Ne'er ishu beiso. It's a mitzvah for the person, for the house. And our question was, well, is it? What's the role of the house? Is it generates the mitzvah? The house needs a menorah. Perhaps the obligation is on the person, but the house is nonetheless maybe critical to fulfilling that obligation. Could be. Either way, the house plays a central role. And the question, if we may ask, is why? I know why the menorah plays a central role. It's Zeichel HaMikdash. But why does the house play a central role? And what that means, by the way, is the notion of lighting in a public place, and one would think the more public the better, in a park or in a town square, is not the mitzvah of Hanukkah, even though it's more presuminisa, but it's no one's house. So you're missing the setting for the mitzvah. But why is the house critical now? It seems to be almost working against you. And the Surah Shlomo Zalman Orbach says that the reason why you need a house, it's a fascinating final stroke after all the halachas have been sorted out. You need a house for the mitzvah because that's also Zeichel HaMikdash. Because the menorah was lit in a house. It wasn't lit in the town square. It was lit in the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore the frame or the field of the mitzvah, the critical component parts were the lights and the house. Zeichel HaMikdash. The house reflects the mikdash part of Zeichel HaMikdash. So says Rav Shlomo Zalman. And I think there's an amazing lesson here. Because if you tell me that the house is important for the mitzvah because of Zeichel HaMikdash, I could think of another house or another building that is much more intuitively Zeichel HaMikdash, and if we really want to have that Zeicher, it should be there, which is a shul. And as we know, that's not true. The shul is the Mikdash Ma'at. The shul for us, when you think, what do we have that's in lieu of the Beis HaMikdash now? Closest thing is the shul. So if you want to have Zeichel HaMikdash, you put it all together, so the light should be lit in shul. Now we know that that's not the mitzvah. It's a much later minhag, and it's a chiddush that we make a bracha on it, which we've discussed in an earlier year. But it's certainly not the mitzvah. No one is yotzei with the lighting in shul. It's presumi nissa, and it's good, and it's a minhag Yisrael. Everyone goes home with 100% obligation to light at home. That's where I think really the message that's coming forward is, in this context, with regards to this mitzvah, the shul is not the Zeichel HaMikdash. The house is the Zeichel HaMikdash. Because it's a statement about the house. As if to say, if this is a mitzvah that's given to you for Golus, it's about how you define yourself, so that means that your house is now the Mikdash, not the shul. It's very good to go to shul, it's very important to go to shul, but you live at home. And what a way to be told that your house is like a Beis HaMikdash, other than your house is critical to the lighting of the menorah, Zeichel HaMikdash. Then all of a sudden someone's telling you, yeah, your house is the Mikdash. It's your sanctuary. That's where you define yourself. That's where you define your life, your identity. And that's a gift that's given to every Jew, wherever he lives. Chanukah says, your house is the Mikdash. And with that inspiring lesson, one may use the time of Chanukah, Bayamim Ahem Bazman Hazeh, the struggle began then, and it continues today. But that means that the miraculous quality of Chanukah existed then, and it reverberates on a yearly basis. So these are 8 days. 8 days is quite a long time. It's the longest Chag we have. So 8 days is the longest. But in a sense, they're 8 days to absorb and to reconfirm and recharge in terms of the way that we look at ourselves. We need it. We need it for the rest of the year. So Mitzvah Hashem, these are lessons that should guide us, accompany us through Chanukah. We shall have a Freilich Chanukah, a Lichlich Chanukah, we shall have Besuras Tovos. And as I mentioned at the beginning, Mitzvah Hashem, we will meet again in 2 weeks' time.